back for another session. This one is going to be on investment in building the Web 3.0, or otherwise known as the decentralized web. And with us, we've got a couple of builders and one investor. I'd like to meet you all, Tom, Min, and Ben Lifshitz from Brave. Before we get into the discussion, I want to go over what you guys do and what your companies do. So if you can give us a little introduction of who you are and what your company does and what you're trying to solve.
Yeah, so we started off life about a year ago as Credit Mint, and we were really looking to tackle one of the few asset classes that could be fully passed through Ethereum mainnet, which is the syndicated loan, and looking to do an end-to-end rebuild of the digital asset, the settlements process, and in the long term enable more people to get access to that credit market. We were very strongly of the view we had to be on a public chain, not a private chain. And in the process of trying to build out this platform, we built a privacy protocol called Aztec, which we released 2 weeks ago. And we're now going to be making available to other digital asset builders to create privacy on Ethereum mainnet.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming. I'm Min and I work for Consensus. Consensus is a global venture production studio that builds decentralized applications and infrastructure on Ethereum. I specifically work for Consensus Labs, which is the incubation platform that has launched 60 of Consensus's companies, including Infura, Truffle, MetaMask, many kind of core components of the Ethereum stack. In my role, I am privileged to meet a lot of amazing entrepreneurs every day. So today is no exception, certainly.
Thanks. I'm Ben. I work for Brave, Brave browser. Some of you are probably using it. We have about 5 million users at this point. So Brave is a user-facing product. It's something you can download on your desktop or mobile device. There are several distinguishing features. So it starts with us blocking third-party ads by default, which generally makes the browser faster, and that's what users tend to like. But on top of that, we're also building our own ad delivery ecosystem that's based on a token called Basic Attention Token, or BAT. And that's what we're working really hard on releasing in the next several months. So it's a combination of something that people like as an alternative browser, but also creating a gateway to a different way to reward users for their attention, but also opening a gateway to something that will hopefully emerge in the Web 3.0 space.
So all of you seem to have something in common, which is that you're building on the Ethereum platform. And obviously the whole idea of the Ethereum platform is to build for the decentralized web. It wants to be a framework for that. But for those people that aren't familiar with the term the decentralized web or Web 3.0, can all of you maybe give us a small summary of how you understand that whole term and in general what it stands for? Let's start with Ben maybe.
Well, so yeah, this is one of those things that means different things to different people. I mean, for me, I think we are starting to see some interesting decentralized apps or dApps emerging. Not a lot, quite frankly. I think we could, we hopefully will see more in the coming year, but the idea is that, as a web browser, we can provide a gateway to this kind of newly emerging space. That is to say, if you have a wallet in the browser and there's a site that is basically serving a decentralized app, then the browser could be the sort of the visual surface, if you will, for the user to interact with such a thing. Now, at the same time, I think we need to see more in this space. We certainly see certain applications, like, for example, there's a decentralized version of Twitter, there is Steemit, but frankly, I think there's more that needs to be built here.
I would actually be really curious to see what the investor point of view on Web 3.0 is. So if you can also comment on that, that would be great.
Sure. I mean, I think from, like Ben said, it really means different things to different people. To me, I think it's about how we approach the services that we need and how now and how we're going to approach them in the future. So if you think about it, like, you know, historically, trust and power have been very closely intertwined, right? We trust an entity, hence we give them power over our services, our data, a lot of private information. I think if you look around today, we now have a situation where there's power, but not a lot of trust. You know, we have sort of a lot of the power of, like, you know, in terms of internet access is very much concentrated in the hands of 4 or 5 big players. Despite a lot of, you know, I think, you know, ill sentiment towards Facebook, they still hoard a lot of our data, and there's not very much we can do about it. So can we think about a paradigm where there's trust but no power? So people can access their services they need. They can, you know, actually host the data in the way, in a self-sovereign way, based on a lot of the core ideologies of decentralization, which is empowerment, bilateralization, trustlessness, immutability. So I think we're really interested in seeing projects that are building towards that new paradigm shift.
Yeah, I mean, I think echoing some of Min's points, I think historically, if we ask, what does it mean to own an asset? If it's a physical asset, there's a physical custody and there's a legal custody. If we're talking about a lot of large immovable physical assets, often the gospel of who owns that asset is within the mandate of a government, and we may not see that change for a long time. As far as financial assets are concerned, the core gospel tellers to date have been Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, and by the way, they will remain powerful financial players for a long, long time, so that they're not going anywhere. But we have, with Ethereum, seen a vehicle which allows that mandate to be conferred into a well-behaving, antagonistic network of people who don't trust one another, and therefore are the best possible place people to create custody at the lowest marginal cost. So that's really what, to us, a blockchain gives you. And of course, once you've conferred the custody of an asset into this antagonistic environment, which actually is a very safe environment. By the way, we rely on it a lot. If you want to leave your laptop on a train seat or something, and you want to go to the food carriage, you'll create a moral web, a moral a trustless net, which is very similar to a blockchain, but without the transactions, by saying to the person next to you, look, will you hold on to my things? Will you hold on to my laptop? And that's a very valuable thing, but it's a closed system. It's a train carriage. And you've picked the person next to you at random. The chances that there is a thief on that carriage are very high. But the chances that someone you've selected at random, i.e. the person next to you, very, very low. And by saying it to them, you broadcast to all the other people sitting around them, by the way, this is not this person's laptop, they can't run off with it, and you're now under a moral obligation to watch. Ethereum swaps out the laptop for any kind of asset expressed on it natively in the first place, and it swaps out the moral obligation for an economic obligation. So I think that's the way that we see a blockchain.
Thanks for the explanation. Ben wants to add something?
Yeah, I'd like to comment as well. So, when it comes to the web, it's important to think about how it's monetized, right? So, I mean, the web, for such a long time, we've been used to a web that's generally been appeared free to us, but of course it's not the case, right? If you think about how content monetization works. And so for a long time, we've had advertising being the vehicle of content monetization, but it's really a system that's changing a lot these days, right? So in part because advertising is really difficult to use as a monetization vehicle, given the click-through rates being so low. Right, and now what you've seen in the last 5 to 7 years is the emergence of these walled gardens like Facebook and to some extent Google as well, where actually advertising within those walled gardens works well, but outside of that it's really difficult to get much done. And so, you know, if you're a small blogger wanting to get paid for your content, well, these days you're largely out of luck. And so what we've seen is a push toward other ways to monetize content, and this is where Brave comes in as well. We'd like to give back to the publisher, give back to the content creator, right? And so that's what we do. So we support, say, YouTube channel creators. We have something like 15,000 publishers on the Brave platform. But I mean, in principle, the problem it's solving is to how to monetize content, right? I mean, we see the system breaking all around us in so many different ways. One way is that we see paywalls coming up everywhere, just about, right? Look at The Guardian, look at The Telegraph. I mean, there's almost not a single valuable, I would argue, interesting kind of newspaper, news magazine out there these days that doesn't have some sort of a paywall. And this calls for a different model of monetizing the web, and I think this is Web 3.0 can be absolutely crucial. The fact that we support transactions in exchange of monetary value as a first-class principle, I think that's tremendous. And I think we'll see all sorts of interesting models emerging on this platform as a result of that, just because, frankly, the current system is not really working. The web is no longer free, and we are more and more aware of that as users as well.
So yesterday I was talking with Kavita Gupta from Consensus, I'm sure you're familiar, and we were chatting about how it's no secret that the market has been struggling since basically the massive boost in interest in December last year and January this year. The market has the value has collapsed about 80 to 90%, and that is starting to affect companies in the space in a big way. We've seen tons of blockchain startups like SpankChain, the Ethereum Classic, a couple of Ethereum Classic development teams have had to shut down efforts because they, even though they believe in what they're building, they no longer have the resources to work with that. So we also see companies reaching into their reserves deeply. Consensus also had to make a big restructuring and downsize by 13% so they can focus on growth. And I was wondering, how has that difficult time affected your process? And how, for the builders, my question, I guess, would be, how are you making sure that you still stay on track and you have enough resources to build what you want to do? And then for the investors, how do you make sure that you basically have a chance to stimulate growth for those companies that you invest in, but also make a profit and also not stifle their innovation by taking too much equity? Let's start with the investors. Yeah, I think it's easier.
Sure. I mean, I think from an investor's point of view, like, you know, bear markets are the best time to buy because you create convexity at the front and you buy cheaply, if anything, right? Like where you have there's less competition on the capital provider side. If you have capital to deploy, you're in a very, very strong position. I think, you know, when we sort of assess companies, like, you know, and we sort of look at what's been happening in the market, you know, of course, I think, you know, the bear market will definitely cause a lot of people to rethink their budgets, tighten their belts, think more like, okay, well, if this bear market is not just protracted, but, you know, if there's a way it goes further, like, how do we survive? You need to sensitize, not a lot of analysis. I will also say that the bear market is probably the best thing for productivity. You know, Consensus published actually Ethereum by the numbers sometime last week. I encourage everyone to take a look at their blog post. But, you know, when you look at sort of like truffle downloads, like, you know, I think we're up like 20% like month on month and like, you know, way surpass a million. Same thing with MetaMask, like Infura is handling about 10 billion requests a day. You know, we continuously see more interest in the space, more people shipping code, more smart contracts being uploaded. So I would say, if anything, there's probably a inverse correlation between prices and shipping. And I think it's also really good training for entrepreneurs. At the end of the day, you have to learn how to scale a company, but you also have to learn how to sort of bootstrap a company. And, you know, maybe everything ebbs and flows, right? Like, you know, at the end of the day, we are still tied to very nascent cyclical markets. And, you know, when in a bull market, everyone's a hero. But in a bear market, I truly believe the strongest will survive. So.
Yes, I mean, as far as the bear market is concerned, I mean, we started our company during the height of the boom, and we refused to do an ICO, and I still feel that was right. The bear market, we should remember, is a bear market in assets, which overwhelmingly have no intrinsic value. So to me, that's rationalism. But I think, you know, if you look at the native token on a blockchain, that's been a necessary piece of kind of bootstrapping. I'm not sure whether you call it economics, but it's been necessary to have a native token which has some sort of exogenous value, which is available to inject into the network to bootstrap consensus. It was necessary. I'm not sure we'll need to cleave to it in the long term, but we needed them to begin with. It just set an unfortunate precedent in the form of utility tokens, which have a number of sort of odd properties in their most kind of vanilla sense. They have no claim on economics. They are, unless they're hyperliquid, which the liquidity can only come from speculation anyway, they create a friction on the market that they're supposedly built to serve. They create FX risks for the people transacting in them. And finally, and most absurdly, is, aside from speculative investment, these utility tokens are predicated on money velocity. Now, on a blockchain that's improving, money velocity increases. The net frictional demand on the token goes down. So these utility tokens are, in some sense, and I'm not sure in a very strong sense, but in some sense, long the protocol, the immediate protocol that they serve. In other words, the project that's set up on another blockchain. But they're actually financially short the efficiency of the blockchain on which they depend for their very survival. So to me, this bear market is really just everyone sort of coming out of the primordial soup of kind of not hugely literate economics. And there is a new form of capital here, I think, by the way, truth capital. I think, you know, we see it today in the form of mining equipment. Truth capital is expressed today in the form of mining equipment. It may be expressed in other ways at some point in the future. So the ability to attest to a record of events, which has been dispassionately created by a blockchain, that may be a new form of capital. The rest of this stuff, like STOs and whatever, this is just rebinding existing assets onto a better ledger. That's all it really is. So if there's one new form of capital, maybe it's truth capital. I don't think we speak enough about that. As far as utility tokens and the general bear market, I think that's rationalism.
Well, we're certainly seeing a lot of change around us, aren't we? So, I mean, one a few things to point out. One of them is a lot easier to recognize teams that are executing well. And there are not that many teams that are actually executing well or have been for a long period of time, and so it's a lot easier to spot them. That's definitely one thing. Another thing is that, well, hiring becomes easier in many ways. I think that's a positive. A third thing is that, well, I don't know, some people certainly become a lot more humble and I think, you know, get to the point a lot more quickly. So there is a lot less noise and I think there is generally more action from teams and people who can execute. And I think those are fairly positive aspects certainly in the long run. So we'll see that for the foreseeable future and then there'll be another wave, which we can probably not predict at the moment.
So I think we have time for about just one more question. I think for a final question, it would be very good if all of you can give me a prediction for 2019 as far as Web 3.0 goes and how it's going to turn out, and then what your best case scenario is and maybe what your worst case scenario is for each one, depending on your company and, you know, your position within that company. Nobody wants to start.
Well, I mean, my personal hope is that we'll see a dApp that has a lot of intrinsic value to the end user. And I think it will come. It's just the question is, well, will it happen in 2019 or 2020 or later than that? Right? Usually these things take a while. Usually there is a platform, there is enough technology, and then somebody figures out a different way to do things that appeals to a massive number of people. We're not there yet. So what we've seen so far in Web 3.0 is like glimpses, mostly people remaking existing apps that are centralized to be decentralized. And I don't think that's quite enough. I think we need to move beyond that. Now, in terms of other predictions, well, I think we'll see some platforms that that have been built over the last 3 years or so. Some of them will probably disappear. Frankly, I don't think we need that many platforms. There's just no intrinsic need for having, I don't know, 15 different platforms on which to build. And people's ability to pick a platform on which to build is really quite limited. Not that many builders are ultimately out there, I would argue. So I think we'll see some creating destruction and perhaps a wave of contagion as a result of that. So that could be a pretty bad outcome as far as I'm concerned. And I think a good outcome would be us discovering that wonderful and powerful and attractive dApp to which we could sort of all open, you know, gateways to, if you will.
Sure. I think on the tech side, like, you know, I'm personally very excited for Ethereum 2.0 Serenity. You know, I think a lot of smart minds in the Ethereum community are working tirelessly on it. And it's absolutely critical, you know, we upgrade the base layer protocol. I think, you know, people are sort of targeting for more details. So you can think about sort of implementation and transition by the end of the year. So certainly hope that happens. You know, I think in terms of another sort of prediction is, you know, I'm hopeful that the bear market actually provides more entry points for new entrants into the market. You know, Fred Wilson from USV had a great post the other day just talking about Amazon back in like 2000, where, you know, it dropped from in price all the way to $9 And like people are like, oh, Amazon is over. And now, I mean, if you bought Amazon at $9, you would be doing quite well for yourself today. So, you know, I do think if anything, if the lower entry points will encourage more people to take a look, maybe, you know, use some of the Ethereum dApps. It's cheaper to stake. It's, you know, gas is a lot cheaper now. And I think, you know, we can kind of focus on that mainstream adoption. It could be one, you know, positive benefit of the bear market.
I'd like to think that we'll see high notional assets held in more disseminated fragmented ownership on public chains in 2019. It might be that we still remain in incubation proof of concept territory for a while on that, but I think, you know, banks and actually more other institutions as well will realize you don't fully emancipate capital, you don't relieve yourself of the shackles of reconciliation we're all still engaged in, even though we're in the digital age, until you're on a publicly attested to ledger where there's a separate economic consensus around all the transactions that you've done. So I think we'll see a lot more experimentation from institutions on public chain technology using, hopefully, Aztecs or other privacy protocols.
Thank you, Ben, Min, and Tom, for sharing your insights with us. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in to listen to those insights.